Does Satan exist? We're going to spend the next several weeks talking about Satanology. Let's start with our apologetic as to why we would believe this subject is even worthy of our study. Well, as we broach this topic, we've seen in American Christendom two extremes with regard to Satan. Obsession to the point of craziness, and then denial to extreme levels. C.S. Lewis was the first to speak about this in his book, The Screwtape Letters. In the preface, he says, there are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils, demons, Satan. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves, the demons, are equally pleased by both errors and hail a materialist, an atheist, only believes in the material, or a magician with the same delight. That's prophetic language from Lewis. Let's think about the first category, obsession with Satan, obsession with demons. Modern examples are galore. If you study church history, it's there as well. Some pretty fantastic tales about demons and Satan and all sorts of stuff that you read. You can't read it in a George R.R. Martin book. I mean, it's incredible the imagination people had. Today, there is still incredible obsession in charismatic circles where people are constantly talking about demons and everything is the demon of this or the demon of that. If you're addicted to cigarettes, you have the demon of nicotine. They believe there's a demon called nicotine, and he influences people to be addicted. There's the demon of heroin. There's the demon of lust. Oh, the demon's been getting to me again. My one buddy went to one of these revival-type meetings at a charismatic church. The guy got up there to speak, and he said, I sense in this audience that there's somebody here who wants to have a demon released from them. Who wants to come forward for some healing? And so my buddy was there, and he was with his buddy. His friend kind of sheepishly walked up to the front. Young man, what do you need healed from? And he's like, he comes into his ear, whispers. The guy comes back, and he goes, all right. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and the power of the Holy Ghost, by the authority of the God the Father, I heal you from the demon of masturbation. He never went back, and I don't think he was healed from that demon either. Anyways, now Satan can tempt us. He can't coerce us. He can't force us. More recently, there was a craze back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, which you can study. It was called satanic ritual abuse. Satanic ritual abuse. Now, as D.A. Carson once said, it's really easy to be a prophet about heresies in the past. It's easy to look back at heresies from the 18th century and say, oh, that was heretical. Very difficult to see heresies in the present and be a prophet about those. That being said, satanic ritual abuse was a widespread pandemic in mostly American evangelicalism, where people were convinced that there were these satanic cults that were capturing people's children and performing gruesome satanic ritual acts. Here's Bob and Gretchen Pasatino. This is from the Christian Research Institute. Now, this is years later. So again, very easy to be a prophet 20 years later, but they describe some of these acts, savage. One act was recorded, a teenage girl who was impregnated during a satanic ritual is forcibly delivered of her nearly term baby and then made to ritually kill the child and eat its heart as cult members watch. Another girl, a small child, is sewn inside the cavity of a disemboweled animal and rebirthed by her cultic captors in a grotesque ceremony. These were some of the lurid, fantastic stories being spread, and overnight, American evangelicalism became obsessed that there were these satanic cults stealing people's children And I could go more R-rated if you wanted. I mean, you could look up these subjects. It gets graphic as anything. Maybe you're familiar with the Netflix show The X-Files. Terrible. If you want to actually entertain yourself, go back to the good show, way better, The X-Files back from the 90s. Fantastic show. And in that show, if you go back and watch reruns, I think that's also on Netflix. I can't remember. Every fifth episode, Mulder and Scully, special agents from the FBI, what are they doing? It's 1993. SRA is all over the place. And so there's all these satanic ritual cults, and they're in the Amish villages always, and Mulder and Scully are getting in there, and everyone's very, you know, placid and stoic and weird and giving you the weird eye. And Mulder and Scully are coming out at night, and they're breaking into the barn and digging, and they come inside, and they're doing all these grotesque acts with these kids and animals, and that was the show, because that was the sign of the day, that there were these secret satanic cults that nobody could catch. Pasatino's write this: when dozens of stories multiplied into the hundreds and then thousands of stories, thousands, none of which produced a single piece of corroborative evidence, some former believers became healthy skeptics. You know, one story turned into two, two turned into four. All of a sudden, thousands of people saying, my child was taken, my child was abused. They write, supervisory special agent Kenneth Lanning of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit has investigated over 300 SRA reports and is yet to find a single bit of corroborative evidence. We had this even in our fellowship where people were coming forward saying, you know, so-and-so, their daughter, 13 years old, babysat our kid, and were convinced that they performed malicious acts to our child with SRA abuse. Like what? Well, they would go into descriptions of what they thought happened. We're like, did you call the cops? Well, no. Was there any physical evidence? Did you see scars? No. How do you know this? Well, my daughter, you know, when I leave the room, she cries. How old's your daughter? 15 months? Okay, any other signs? No, but we want you, the elders, to tell the church that this 13-year-old girl babysitter is part of the SRA cult. Well, the elders uniformly refused to do that. So we're going to ruin a young woman's reputation based on what? Based on nothing. Well, we had people leave our fellowship over this. Well, it came out later. None of this was true. In fact, there is a psychological phenomenon which is referred to as FMS, false memory syndrome. This is scary, okay? This is where somebody can start to put thoughts into your mind about abuse which never occurred. Whenever we're talking to somebody, we have to be very careful. We're not suggesting that they've been abused, or we're telling them we think that they were abused. We think it was this, and we think it was that. My professor from Trinity, he was in a court case where he was brought in to help a young lady who was claiming, I was abused sexually. It was behind the billboard on the corner of 77 and 224 intersection. When was it? April of 2000, whatever. And they went to that intersection. There was never a billboard there. Never happened. How did this happen? Her previous counselor was starting to pick up on things that she was saying and then starting to suggest, by what you're saying, it sounds like you're abused. Huh. Maybe I was. Was it your father? Yeah. Did he do this to you? Did he do that to you? And they basically put these memories into the person's head to the point where if they took a lie detector test, they would pass. My professor was a clinical psychologist, so he went back and testified that this is a real phenomenon. Anyways, that's a tangent. False memory syndrome, SRA, this is an example where people became obsessed with demons and demonology to the detriment of pastors, parents. We had examples of, in the 90s, parents being separated from their own kids. Kids convinced that their parents put them through an SRA abuse session. Never happened. So obsession would be a mistake. The other extreme would be denial. This is likely where most of us would fall. denial. George Barna, the great pollster, statistician, back in 2009, he said 4 out of 10 Christians, 40%, strongly agreed that Satan is, quote, not a living being, but is a symbol of evil. Not a real personal spiritual being. He's symbolic of evil. An additional 2 out of 10 Christians, 19%, said they, quote, agree somewhat with that perspective, that they're inclined to agree with that. A minority of Christians indicated that they believe Satan is real. This would be the other extreme. So there could be obsession, and there's problems with that. Deadly problems with being obsessed with seeing a demon underneath every stone and behind every door. That's unhealthy. But to be cynical, to be skeptical, to deny it, that also has problems. What exactly is the evidence for the existence of Satan? One evidence which is necessary but not sufficient would be evidence from the soul, as theologians refer to it, or the mind is what philosophers call it. Simply put, do you believe that you are just physical parts, juices, electricity, a modified primate, a meat machine, as one philosopher put it, a moist robot? Basically, you're purely physical. If you believe that you're entirely physical, there's nothing non-physical, there's nothing spiritual, you're material, there's nothing immaterial about you, who you are, essentially. This would mean that you are controlled by the laws of physics. This would mean things like free will, out the window. Morality, out the window. Regretting the past, fearing the future. If you're just a physical being that's changing over time, why are you worried about the future? You won't be there when you get there. You'll be essentially different physical parts. What do you mean you chose a wrong decision? Physics programmed it into you through your brainstem and your central nervous system. That's it. We're more complicated than other machines, but we're still machines. We're still just as determined. If, like me, you believe that there's good evidence for an immaterial mind, that yes, we have a brain, but our mind, our soul, uses our brain. And, in fact, if our brain was destroyed, if that was cast away, our mind would continue to exist. Let me put this real simply. If you died right now, where would you go? Well, from a physicalist perspective, nowhere. You're there, on the ground, on the curb. From a Christian worldview, we believe that the mind goes to heaven. You know, they're in a better place. Well, if there's a soul, the existence of a soul, then we've just opened up a door into the spiritual realm. We're saying that there's no less than 7.5 billion personal spiritual beings on earth right now. Speaking, of course, of humans. God, is he physical? Does he have a brain, a physical brain? No. He's an unembodied mind, an infinite, personal, unembodied soul, spiritual being. So there would be another example. What about angels? Is it possible that God created humans that are embodied souls, and yet he also created angels who are unembodied souls or spirits? Really, from God's perspective, we're the weird ones. Right? Not to Jesus. He knows all about it. But from God's perspective, we are soulish beings that are embodied, unified that way. Angels would be a whole race or series of species that don't have bodies. So the real question would become, did God create angels with free will? If you're willing to grant the premise that there's billions of humans who have souls, God is essentially spiritual in nature, that opens up the door to what if he created other spiritual beings? And if so, do those spiritual beings have free will? If humans can turn into sadistic dictators, we believe that, Pol Pot, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, why not angels? If it's possible for a human to give the finger to God, rebel, and wreak havoc on big portions of the population, which is demonstrably true, we've seen that, is it also possible that there are angelic beings that can likewise reject God's authority? Number 2, biblical evidence. Biblical evidence. 19 of the 27 New Testament books mention Satan. Every New Testament author mentions Satan. And Jesus of Nazareth spoke about Satan more than anyone in the Bible. Constantly talked about Satan. Talked about him. He was there in the beginning. I watched him fall like lightning. He's the adversary. If you ask Jesus, who I believe had the correct worldview, he got it right about reality. Is there a Satan? Jesus says, yes, absolutely there is. And for me, for somebody who believes that the Bible, there's good reasons to believe in the Bible, that would speak to this being a feature of reality, that there is a Satan. The Bible claims to be a window into the nature of the spiritual realm. So what gives us the right to pull out the Sharpie marker and blot out the innumerable passages, copious in number, okay, throughout the Bible, which mention Satan, even on the lips of Jesus, and just say, well, we don't believe that part. On what basis do you do that? Finally, number three, direct perception. Direct perception. Interestingly enough, a couple years ago, I was reading Scientific American where the arch skeptic, Michael Shermer, founder of the Skeptic Society. This guy is the most notable American atheist on earth today. He wrote this article for Scientific American called Anomalous Events That Can Shake One's Skepticism to the Core. He tells this story. He was married in June of 2014, so this was freshly written after his marriage. His wife, his soon-to-be wife, had a grandfather who couldn't make it to the funeral because he had passed away years earlier. And so her grandfather, before he died, gave a transistor radio to Michael Shermer's wife. And the wife really valued this. I mean, she loved this transistor radio. Whenever she'd play it, she'd think of her grandpa. It just was a really sentimental thing to her. And so as a gift before the wedding, Michael Shermer, who's a scientist, was looking at this transistor radio and it had broken and he was trying to fix it. Because he thought to himself, how cool would it be if I could fix this before my wedding, be a gift to my wife. She wanted her grandfather to be there. He couldn't. I mean, it's a real sentimental thing. Well, this is a brilliant man. He could not get this transistor radio to work. He tried everything. He replaced all the connections, so on and so forth. The day of the wedding, the transistor radio began to work and started playing music through the house. And him and his wife, soon to be, walk into the room, and they're standing there in front of this transistor radio as it's playing music. After the wedding, the transistor radio broke, never to play again. He couldn't get it to fix after this event happened. And so it shook him. He wrote this in the article at the conclusion. He says, if we are to take seriously the scientific credo to keep an open mind and remain agnostic when the evidence is indecisive or the riddle unsolved, we should not shut the doors of perception when they may be open to us to marvel in the mysterious. I have to admit, this event rocked me on my heels and shook my skepticism to its core as well. What's the point that he's making? He's saying, yes, reason, analysis, empiricism, that's one way to see reality. And yet there's another way to perceive it, which is just perceiving it directly. There's something about this article that kind of bugged me, though. Okay. How odd is it that his skepticism was, how did he put it, shaken to my core because of a transistor radio? He's looking at these awesome arguments, very cogent, very persuasive for the existence of God. No, that didn't shake his skepticism one bit. But a transistor radio works one day and stops working the next. And oh man, I was really shaken really badly. I thought that was pretty pitiful, to be honest. But there's something to it. I think there's a thread of truth. He's showing us something there. To be able to perceive something directly would be one of the ways of knowing. Think of Switzerland back in World War II. The red represents the Axis powers. The blue represents the Allies. And there, smack dab in the middle, is Switzerland. They weren't going to go with the Axis. They weren't going to go with the Allies. They're just going to remain nonpartisan and be neutral, like Switzerland always is, and not take part on one side or the other. Now imagine living in Switzerland. You're a young boy or girl. You wake up. You read in the papers like, yeah, there's a war happening in France, wherever that is. And, oh yeah, there's an Eastern Front and a Western Front and a Pearl Harbor. And you're reading about all this. And it's like, yeah, I heard that there's a war. But, you know, I look around my town. There's no war. Everything's pretty safe. Business as usual. What do you think would happen if Switzerland took a side in that war? All of a sudden, if they signed up with the Allies, very quickly they would perceive directly that there's a war. The same thing is true with regard to spiritual warfare. People who may have not sensed any kind of spiritual warfare before becoming a Christian, they didn't sense this at all. They didn't sense a Satan, spiritual warfare. As soon as you pick a side, all of a sudden you become a target. You're like Switzerland with courage. There was this video that was on YouTube, Facebook all the time where the bigger brother is coming into the shower and he keeps putting shampoo on the kid's head. It goes on like this for 3 minutes and he keeps pressing the button and he keeps trying to get the shampoo out of his head and he keeps putting more in there. And I was just thinking about that picture there, you know, from a closed system where the guy is just sitting there in front of the shower and the soap suds keep coming down and he's just scraping at his head. What is wrong with me here? Where's this shampoo coming from? And ignoring that there could be someone outside the system coming in that's pouring that shampoo on top of your head. I wonder if that's the way it is with us and Satan. We're Christians who are just like, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. I'm not going to acknowledge it. Satan loves that. Satan is capitalizing on that. He loves the idea that you wouldn't just turn around and face him. How could it be possible? 60% of Christians do not believe in Satan. How is that possible? Well, I believe that there's two alternatives. One would be that Satan is imaginary. And those 60% are right. They're in the right. Or 60% of Christians are currently being deceived by him. That would be the other alternative. That's the one I favor. The deceiver, the father of lies, the accuser, probably the best strategy he could ever take would be to deceive 2/3 of the army that he doesn't exist. Reminds me of the scene from Usual Suspects here. You ever seen this movie?
He's supposed to be Turkish. Some say his father was German. Nobody ever believed he was real. Nobody ever knew him or saw anybody that ever worked directly for him. But to hear Kobayashi tell it, anybody could have worked for Soze. You never knew. That was his power. The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Great line. Great line. All right, let's think about this question that comes up in critical studies. The evolution of Satan. Critics of the Bible go down to Columbus State, Ohio State, take your Bible as literature class. This is what you'll be taught. That the concept of Satan, an adversary of God, a deceiver, accuser, malevolent spirit, that was a concept that evolved. That's not something that was, you know, in the Old Testament from page one. That's something that became more and more elaborate until you reach the end of the Old Testament. And we have more and more demons and more angels. And then the New Testament, it becomes fully evolved into a full-blown Satanology. Okay, let's think about this. Let's define and defend this view before we destroy it. Satan is rarely mentioned in the Old Testament. How about that? I think they're right about that. Not that often. Critical scholarship holds that Satan evolved to be the enemy of God by about 200 BC. They would date the book of Daniel to about 167 BC. And there you have, you know, the prince of Persia, demons, angels galore. Angels are all over the place. And at that point, it would make sense to believe that you have a concept of Satan. In the intertestamental period, from the end of the Old Testament into the New, this concept evolved, and then Jesus, a Jewish rabbi, spoke about it. He wasn't God, but he was holding the view of the day that there was a personal Satan. Moreover, they would argue, there's passages in the Old Testament that actually refer to Satan as a good guy. Like Numbers 22:22, the angel of the Lord, who's that? Good guy or bad guy? In my view, that's Jesus, really good guy. The angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary, Satan. The angel of the Lord, Satan, against him. Now he was riding on his donkey and his two servants were with him. So the angel of the Lord is referred to as Satan, Satan. What about this passage? 2 Samuel 24. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel and it incited David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. Who took the census in 2 Samuel 24? The Lord caused it. The Lord did it. Then we flip over to the parallel passage in 1 Chronicles 21. Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. So who caused the census? Ah, the chronicler says, I've got 2 Samuel 24. It says the Lord did it, but ooh, boy, that would make the Lord look pretty bad. How can we get the Lord off the hook? Satan. Satan. It wasn't God, it was Satan who did it. Gerhard Kittel, critical theologian, he says it is striking how rarely the Satan notion is expressed in the Old Testament. The few Old Testament references initiated further development in pre-New Testament Judaism, and this finally produced many combinations of the Satan concept with originally very different ideas. The attributing to Satan of many features which derive from such independent sources as the story of fallen angels and with no original reference to Satan. This idea evolved. Originally, Satan didn't mean a fallen angel, malevolent creature. Kittel says it should be stressed that the idea of Satan originally had nothing whatsoever to do with human impulses or with fallen angels. Read or go down and take a Bible as literature class. That's exactly what they'll share with you. G. Ernest Wright, critical theologian, Harvard, says in the Old Testament, clear references to demons are rare. The world of Satan with its powers and principalities of darkness is a development in later Judaism. So definite is the Old Testament in its exaltation of God that all things good and bad were ascribed to him. The doctrine of Satan, however, gradually came into being to alleviate the difficulties inherent in this view. You see that? Okay, in the way, way Old Testament, good and evil both came from God. But once you get further along, they start to realize, ooh, that's a problem. How do we worship a God that's both good and evil? Satan. They created a Satan. To which I would reply, so it took the Jewish people 1,000 years to realize that God was allowing evil? And moreover, how would this even help to say that God is allowing a malevolent spirit being to do evil, torture, death, whatever? How does that even help the view? How does that create a plausible theodicy, an explanation as to why God would allow evil? So we're seeing two different perspectives here. There's the what I'm calling the Christian view and the critical view. You could call this the Bible-believing view and the critical view. The Christian view would say that Satan was progressively revealed. Picture Wheel of Fortune, where you have all the different letters up there. And one letter is revealed, and then another, and then another, and then another, and then another, until you can solve the puzzle. That's progressive revelation, revealing. The critical view, by contrast, it's not that this concept was being revealed, it's that this concept was morphing and changing, evolving. That originally Satan's a good guy, and then later he morphs into a bad guy. The Christian view is that this was revealed over time. The critical view is that this was changed over time. The Christian view is that the biblical authors learned more about Satan, whereas the critical view is that the biblical authors invented more, even contradicting earlier authors. If Satan is a good guy in the Old Testament, then Jesus got it wrong. Jesus seems to believe that Satan is a bad guy. So do you see the distinction? I'm not saying you have to agree with it, but just you get the 2 points. Okay. How would we respond to this? For one, early references to Satan are often ignored. Often ignored. Think of Genesis 3. How do they get around that? Genesis 3, it says that there's this Satan in the garden. Does it say that there was a Satan in the garden? It says there was a serpent in the garden. And yes, he deceives the first humans and he accuses God and he's malevolent and he brings a domino effect that ruins the human race, but he's called the serpent. He's not called Satan. And you might say, wait a minute, I've got Revelation 12:9. John says, the serpent of old, the devil. And they'd say, oh, well, that's John. He's writing in 90 AD. This text is from 1,000 years earlier, on their view. How does John know what the author of Genesis is thinking? That's the critical view. What about Ezekiel 28, where it refers to this cherub who falls and was in the Garden of Eden and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Well, that's referring to the king of Tyre. Ezekiel 28 verse 11 says this is addressed to whom? Satan? No, it's addressed to the king of Tyre. What about Job? Job 1 and 2. Who is he called? Is he called the serpent? Is he called the king of Tyre? No, he's called Satan. Satan comes into the throne room of God. He appeals to the angels. And there we go. Bada boom, bada bing. Satan. Evil. They would say, no, he's called Satan because he's an adversary. Really, he's like God's attorney. He's just coming up into the heavenly realm and he's talking with God. What about Job? What about this? What about that? And he's asking for permission to go test Job's fidelity to God. So basically what I'm saying here is they're doing gymnastics, getting around the very clear Old Testament references. Number two, when Satan appears, the Bible feels no need to explain him. Isn't that odd? If this was some kind of evolutionary development, and they were coming up with new doctrine, which was in distinction from old doctrine in the Old Testament, why wouldn't they say something about it? Why wouldn't they say, yes, Satan used to be God's advocate, a good angel, and now he's become an evil angel. And he's actually the reason for all evil on earth. No explanation. In fact, we just have the serpent in the garden. What's he doing there? No explanation. Number three, early references to demons are undeniable. Remember G. Ernest Wright? He says they're very rare, but they're there. Early and undeniable references to demons. Think of Leviticus 17:7. No longer sacrifice their sacrifices to the goat demons. What's a goat demon? I don't know. I have no idea. But that's from the book of Leviticus. I mean, on the critical mindset, that's going back to the beginning. Or think of Deuteronomy 32. Oh, even earlier in the critical mindset, the law, Deuteronomy. They sacrifice to demons who are not God, to gods whom they have not known. Deuteronomy 32:17. Psalm 106:37. They even sacrifice their sons and daughters to the demons. There are references to demons, evil spirits. How do we know they're evil? Well, they're accepting child sacrifice. How about that? That's about as evil as it gets. Furthermore, the evolutionary hypothesis of Satan, that basically he started as God's advocate, his attorney, and then somehow down the line, later biblical authors realized, hey, we got to have a patsy for evil, so we should turn Satan into that patsy, make him the source of evil. That concept of an evolutionary development from little demons to tons of demons contradicts itself and it contradicts another critical theory of the Bible, namely the evolution of monotheism. The evolution of monotheism. After Charles Darwin published his On the Origin of Species in 1859, theorists in all sorts of different domains began to apply Darwinism to their discipline. So you had social Darwinism. You had ethical Darwinism. You had eugenics, that we should only have the U genes, the good genes, and proliferate the right kind of people. Then you had such a thing as religious Darwinism, religious Darwinism. This is the concept, think of Charles Darwin. You start from a primitive life form, and then it eventually evolves into a greater life form. That's, I know people who know Darwinism are cringing at me saying that, but you get the idea, right? From the lesser to the greater, to the more evolved. And so the thought was, especially among those who studied under Freud, was that ancient people were trying to deal with their guilt and insecurity, and as a consequence, they came up with that there's spiritual beings behind every tree and in the ocean, and they came up with what was called animism. Millions of spirit beings. So this would be the most primitive form of religion. With me so far? Eventually, according to religious Darwinism, you have an upgrade where it's not millions of spiritual beings, but instead there are many different gods. It's not animistic, it's polytheistic. Poly meaning many, and theos meaning God. Many finite, limited deities. So I put Zeus up here. Think of the Greek pantheon. Zeus, Hera, Apollos, etc. Then they realized that, well, that's not that sophisticated, so it went up a notch to what's called henotheism. Critics would put Judaism underneath henotheism because we have passages where the psalmist will say, you are the greatest among the gods, or there's no god like you, Yahweh. Henotheism is the concept that there's many gods, like polytheism, but there's really the one god. Think of it, now this has various forms. One form could be a lower henotheism. That'd be like, think of the five families of the mafia, and we're all together, but there's one papa mafioso who's the head of the five families, something like that. Then there's henotheism and Judaism, which they would say, no, the Jews believed in an infinite personal god, but there were all these other gods. So Baal and Ashtoreth, and all these other deities, but Yahweh was the supreme deity over all of them. And then eventually, this morphs into, no, there's not a million spirit beings, there's not many different gods, there's not just one god above the other gods, really there's only one god, monotheos, one god. Now, can you see how this would be a difficulty for this concept of the evolution of Satan? Critics admit that monotheism starts at the beginning of the Bible. Look at what they're admitting. They're saying, well, at the beginning of the Bible, we don't have demons, we don't have Satan, we don't have any of that. And they're saying Satan evolved. Well, if that's the case, then why didn't monotheism evolve? Instead, what we read in the Bible right from the beginning, Genesis chapter 1, right from the start, we have an infinite personal God. He creates from pre-existent matter, from ripping apart the carcass of another God, a la the Enuma Elish. No, nothing like that. We just have God speaks, and there it was. Are the stars God? No, those are part and parcel of the furniture of the universe. Yahweh spoke, created the stars. What about the sun? Should we worship the sun? No, idiot. The sun, that's just something God created. It's to show the seasons, the moon, same thing. So we have monotheism right from the start. Actually, this picture is inverted. So if Satan evolved, why didn't monotheism evolve? Moreover, earlier primitive religion was obsessed with evil spirits. Read Babylonian literature, read Sumerian literature. Constant appeals to magic, coercing spirit beings, getting the spirit beings on your side. We don't have anything like this in the Old Testament. Nothing. And so, as a consequence, these aren't contradictory claims, but what they are is they're competing claims. You can't say that Satan evolved, and yet, but if you admit Satan evolved, then you're admitting that monotheism did not evolve, and that came on the scene in the blink of an eye. If you're trying to argue that Satan did not evolve, then you're saying that they were in with their culture. Here's Jernis Wright. Hopefully this will explain it. Now, this is a Harvard theologian. As I pointed out earlier, he was one of the guys we quoted as to saying that, yeah, mention of demons is very rare. But in his excellent book, The Old Testament Against Its Environment, he says this, He says the surprising thing is not that the cult, that's worship, of magic and divination was known in Israel. It was known. Deuteronomy 18. Don't try and contact the dead. Don't do divination. Don't perform magic. They knew about it, okay? They knew about spirit demonic worship. Wright says, but that it should be so definitively forbidden in the law and associated by the prophets with an idolatry which destroyed rather than saved. They knew about primitive animistic worship, and yet it was just altogether completely forbidden. John Durham, this is from Word Biblical Commentary, which is especially a critical commentary with regard to the Old Testament. Definitely. Durham says this. He says, there are no incantation texts in the Old Testament. Yahweh could not be controlled or even altered in his set purpose by men. Do you have any idea how strange that is? All of the surrounding religious systems were all about, well, what happens when you get pink eye? Oh, well, you put together a little bit of the fish's liver, and then you put some blood in, and then you mix in this, and then you plaster that all over your eyes, and then you pray to this spirit and that spirit. What do you do if you're trying to get fertile, pregnant? Well, you got to cut this and open that up and put the sawdust in and mix everything together and say this chant and use these words. And if you can do these incantations, these magic practices, you can coerce the spirits to do what you want. We don't have a single one of these in the Old Testament. So these are multiply competing claims. You can't say that Satan evolved. They knew about it. They rejected it. So the Jews didn't learn about Satan until 200 BC, when every other religious system was obsessed with spirit beings and magic. It doesn't follow. Okay, what about Numbers 22:22? How do we answer this passage? The angel of the Lord is being called Satan. That seems to show that these are one and the same, does it? It doesn't call him the adversary, the Satan. It calls him an adversary. This is using a word. It's the same word. It's the same vocabulary, but it's using it in a different context. The Hebrews only had a 3,000-word vocabulary. So, oh, it is Satan. It says Satan. Now, that's got to be referring to Satan. Okay, think about the New Testament. What is Satan called in the New Testament? 2 Corinthians 4:4. He's called the theos of this world, the god of this world. So, Paul, when he wrote 2 Corinthians, he must have thought that Satan was God. No. You can use a word in a different context to have a different meaning. In this context, it's saying that the angel of the Lord was standing as an adversary. He even uses the language of simile. Not that he was the Satan, but he's acting as an adversary. Conclusions, like most areas of theology, information about Satan was slowly revealed. In my estimation, God probably slowly revealed this information about Satan because he wanted the focus to be on him, not on Satan. When you look at pre-exilic, like before the exile, Judaism, they had time and time again fallen into idolatry, worship of Baal, worship of Ashtoreth, worship of the Canaanite deities. And God was just like, you don't follow them. You don't worry about them. You focus on me. And so to have an elaborate theology or Satanology would be, it could be misdirecting to the Jewish people.